Hi, welcome to the Chaz Palminteri Show. We have a great guest today from the great Baldwin family, the Baldwin brothers, you've heard of them, famous family. Billy Baldwin will be here today. Billy and I go back a long, long time. You know him in some great movies, Backdraft, one of the, just a fantastic movie, One Eye Jacks, so many great films that Billy has been in. And he will be with us right now. As Billy would always say, he's the white sheep of the family. I'm just kidding. We can cut that out. But I remember that's one of the funniest lines I ever heard. We won't use that line, Bill. I'll do it again.
No, please do. I think it's hilarious.
I think it's a hilarious line. I love it.
They all know it's true. They all know it's true.
Yeah, you always said, I'm the white sheep of the family. So, Bill, you're living out there in the beautiful Santa Barbara. I mean, so many people, want to know about you and about your career and the incredible career you had. Do you want to take us? I know you grew up in Massapequa, right?
Yeah.
And
born in Amityville, raised in Massapequa. And then after that, I left when I was 18 to go to college at Binghamton University, part of the SUNY system. And then I was in D.C. briefly. I interned on Capitol Hill. And then I deferred my acceptance to law school and came to New York. And I decided I wanted to take my first acting class and give that a shot instead of going to law school because I was burnt out on school. I didn't want to keep going. And I was secretly, fantasizing about taking an acting class because my brother had been doing it and he was doing some soap operas in New York. And every time I would go to the city to meet with him, come home for Rosh Hashanah or from Yom Kippur when I was a sophomore, junior in college, he'd say, pop into the city on the train. And I would spend time with him. And Chaz, it's really interesting. Like, I really do love the craft. I really do love the acting. You know, the most important part. But one of the weird things, and maybe you feel the same way, one of the weird things that drew me to the business and drew me to want to do this was every time I met my brother, I would go with him and we'd get sushi. People know my brother's in the program. So sometimes I go to meetings with him. After the meetings, we go out with some friends of his from the program. Invariably, a lot of them were in the business, but they weren't all on our side of the camera. Writers, directors, producers, art direction, set design, costumers. And every time I would go, when I was a young kid, 19, 20 years old, I would always walk away saying, wow, Hollywood doesn't have the smartest people in the world in the business, but a lot of the people are very smart. They are the most creative people in the world. They're incredibly dynamic, incredibly interesting. And there are some of the most broken, dysfunctional, wounded people I've ever encountered in my life. So when you put that like bouillabaisse of like super smart, super creative, very dynamic,
right,
dysfunctional, broken, and you put it all together. I mean, we've met and we've worked with some, and it's reflected in a lot of the people's work, even on the other side of the camera, when you're dealing with art direction, set design, costumers. Some of those people are geniuses and it comes from their pain and their dysfunction. I was drawn to the people in the business.
Right. Bill, but that's an interesting point. I mean, but do you feel that you have to have that pain and dysfunction to be talented?
No.
Okay, no. Good. Because I don't either.
But you have a good balance. I mean, you are a very healthy, functional guy, but you've also survived and lived through, a lot of craziness as reflected in your life story. I mean, you've handled it very well, but you've also, it's not like you haven't seen it.
No, I've seen it, yes.
I think your genius is a reflection of your also, not necessarily your dysfunction, but of those incredible experiences,
Right. And I've always said that when I studied with, I'm in the actor's studio. When I studied with Lee Strasberg, he said to the class, not just to me, and I say this on a few other podcasts, he said, the best artists are the ones who lived. And I never forgot that because of taking all those experiences and putting them into your creative psyche,
Yeah, yeah. My brother studied with Lee too. My brother was one of the last guys to study with Lee. He was at GW in Washington. He finished his junior year. He told this girlfriend of his, he has a dream of becoming an actor and not going to law school. She's like, well, you better squeeze the trigger on that right now because you're about to go into your final year of undergraduate. And all of a sudden, boom, he auditioned for Lee. he got a scholarship, and he was with Lee. He studied with Lee for about a year and a half, and then he left NYU and didn't graduate because he got onto The Doctors on a daytime soap opera in New York.
Right.
One of those, like, Secret Storm, Search of Night.
Right, yes.
One of those old school soaps. And then Lee passed away. My brother was one of the last groups of students that studied with Lee. And then he wound up coming back years later, and he was only a couple of credits short, and he did this retrospective, like this thesis on Pacino's career. And he did, like, in-depth, like 60 hours of interviews with Pacino talking about him, about the craft of acting. And
right.
And that thesis got him his degree. He graduated, like, it was like, you know, it might have been like 10 years, 15 years after he graduated.
Oh, I didn't know that. Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't, you know, it's amazing how four brothers, you know, do you ever find that people think you only have four brothers, they forget about your sisters? Has that ever happened? Like,
I was on the red carpet once, and my sisters had these t-shirts that said, "Nobody, Alec, Daniel, Billy, nothing, Steven." And my sister Beth was pointing to nobody, and my sister Jane was pointing to nothing. And we're all six of us were on the red carpet.
Nobody, oh my God.
Daniel, Billy, nothing, Steven.
Oh God. Because my sisters, both of my sisters, especially that I wrote Bronx Tale About My Life, they always say, "No, we're nobody." They always say that, you know, because, well, when I wrote the Bronx Tale story, I couldn't put my two sisters in the movie because it was basically, I wanted just to be the boy with the father and the wise guy, you know. But my sisters always break my balls about that. And I was just wondering, your sisters must do the same to you guys.
Well, people say it all the time. They're like, "You have sisters?" Because, you know, there's a brand called, really like a brand, the Baldwin, you know, from 1988 to like 1996, like the Baldwin brothers were like a thing, you know? So,
right.
So when you say you have sisters, they're like, "Wait a second, I thought you were the Baldwin brothers." I'm like, "We are, but I also have two sisters."
I know. Bill, do you ever get, I mean, I know it must happen. Do you guys ever get, people ever confuse you who's who?
Every day. Yeah, it happens to me. You know, when you're hot on a show and you're relevant, it's like, "Hey, Billy Baldwin, I love you on that show. I love you on Northern Rescue. I love you on Dirty Sexy Money," whatever it is. "I love you on Gossip Girl." But when you aren't on a show, and it fades quick. Like, if you aren't relevant,
right.
It doesn't even be a show. I remember doing, like, Rosie O'Donnell. And for like the next 3 weeks, I was walking around the streets of New York, and everyone knew they didn't say, you know, it goes from "You're Billy Baldwin" to "You're one of those Baldwin brothers," one to "You're one of those brothers" to "You're Alec Baldwin's little brother" to
right.
"Go to high school together," you know? So where do I know you from? Did we go to high school together? So
I get confused.
With my brother, which is great. He got pulled over one time for speeding on the 101, and the cops said, "You know, I should probably write you the ticket, but seeing as I loved you in Backdraft so much, I'm gonna let you go." And my brother literally turned to the cop and said, "I wish you gave me the ticket instead. I'd have rather have gotten the ticket."
Oh my God. And your brother, he's so quick-witted that I hear him saying that.
Yeah, I'd rather gotten the ticket. That's my brother Billy. I'll take the ticket instead.
I wish you gave me the ticket.
It's nice to hear that he gets confused with me every once in a while, you know?
Billy, four boys growing up, let me not forget your sisters. What the hell was the grocery bill like? I remember me asking you that. God, you must have had like three carts full with milk and everything, right?
You know what? My father took over that part of the job. My mother was always cooking, but my father did the shopping. And he used to get into like clipping out the papers, and he took great pride in how much money he would save. No one would get on the checkout line behind my father because he had two shopping carts with so much stuff filled up in it that it was sliding off and falling off out of the basket, keeping over the top of the basket. And he would get in the line, and no one would want to get behind him because he had two carts filled with stuff, but he had a coupon for like almost, he only bought stuff that he had coupons for.
Wow.
Wipe the place out with a coupon. So he'd buy, like, you know, our grocery bill. That's the one thing about my childhood, I got to say. My father was, you know, a school teacher. He taught government and history, and he coached football and rifle. He ran the winter and summer recreation programs. He was our Little League coach. He was our Cub master. Very, very, like a pillar in our community. He didn't directly only affect us. He had a direct or indirect effect on thousands and thousands of families in my community in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and then they passed away in the early 80s. And But there was a lot of things that we didn't have that other people had, but love was not one of them, and food was not one of them. I mean, every Monday through Saturday was like a Sunday meal. Every Sunday meal was like an Easter or a Thanksgiving meal. And every Thanksgiving was like, you know, an extravaganza. And my father's, the grocery bill was, you know, I remember coming out of there with all of those coupons, and we were still dropping, maybe I'm making this up, but hundreds and hundreds of dollars, probably $350 on groceries.
And that's a fortune back then.
71.
Oh my God, that's a fortune.
Yeah. I mean, my father only made 20 grand a year, 20, 25. Jeez.
You know, you wonder how the hell did they do it? I think about my mom and dad, and, you know, it was just me and my two sisters, and we always ate, we always had great meals, and we always had the most love. And I think that's why, you know, we are the way we are, you know?
Let me ask you a question. You and I are in a position, because of our careers, we're in a position to do things for our children that our parents couldn't do for us.
Yes.
I have an option to send my kids to private school. The six of us went to the same K through 12. No deviation, no homeschooling, no private schooling, no St. John's, no St. Anthony's, no nothing. We all went through the Massapequa Public Schools, where my dad was a teacher at the rival school. That's another story where we used to compete against my father's teams. You remember those stories. And I love that I'm in a position to do things for my kids that my parents couldn't do for me. I always had a job. I had a job from when I was 12 years old. I worked security. I drove a truck. I lifeguarded. I landscaped. I bartended. And I always thought that I would get it right. I always thought I would get the balance right.
Yeah.
Of like, let me do these nice things for my kids, but don't let me overdo it. Let me make sure they have a little bit of that Massapequa.
Yes.
Gratitude, like something you got to fight for, some things you got to work for. And I didn't quite strike the balance in retrospect the way I hoped it.
Yeah, it's hard, Bill. It's very difficult.
You provided for our kids, man.
Well, because they get spoiled by default. Just by being around you, they get spoiled. I mean, sometimes we go to a restaurant and my son will walk in and say, yeah, they said it's an hour wait. Dad, come on in and take off your sunglasses. You know, he'll say that to me. You know, and I'll walk in and the guy go, oh, Mr. Pompeo, yeah. And he'll just say, Dad, well, you know, I didn't want to wait. You know, I said, well, it's fine. It's fine. It's okay.
Yeah, of course. China calls up. I showed her this like New York Magazine article where somebody pretending to be called the top 100 restaurants in New York and said they were Paul Newman. I'm sorry. They called the top 100 restaurants, 50 restaurants in New York, and they tried to make a reservation, and they couldn't get a reservation at like 45 out of 50.
Right.
And they called and said they were calling from Paul Newman's office, and they got into like all but three, because they said they were Paul Newman's office. And I was like, who were the three that turned Paul Newman down? Like,
exactly.
Who the hell turned down Paul like crazy?
Who turned down Paul Newman?
Yeah, like two or three of them said, I'm sorry. Maybe they didn't know who it was. I don't know.
Oh, my God. No, that's – I mean, I just find that – you know, so I try, but I try to tell him sometimes, I go, no, Dante, no, Gabriella, it's too expensive. We're not getting that. You can't have that. I have said that, you know, and then they're so shrewd. So then my son will go, oh, Dad, I know we're not doing that well. If you're not doing that well, then I understand. I go, well, no. What do you mean I'm not doing
this? I want to teach you a lesson.
Yeah, I said, I'm trying to teach you. I know he's trying to work the psychology on me, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, Dad. Oh, I know. I know it's hard. I go, shut up. It's too expensive, and I'm not buying it for you. And I think that's okay because they do respect money. Look, did they respect it as good as you and I did growing up? No. But well,
they couldn't have had that experience. I mean.
Right.
I remember one time recently, like right before COVID, I was in Paris and I was sitting at a restaurant with my friend and he said, hey, check it out. Calvin Klein just sat down and he was sitting right next to me. And I said to my friend, hey, watch this. I go, Calvin. And he looks at me, he gets up, he gives me a hug. He's with a couple of business people. I said, hey, I got to tell you guys a funny story. And I told him how I booked the Calvin Klein campaign. I went to go see my brother, Alex Agin, who you remember, Michael Bloom.
Yes.
And I was still in college. I was in my senior year. And he said, so you want to be an actor? And I said, you know, I want to come to New York for a year and give it a shot, take a couple of acting classes and see. I really am really excited to try it. I mean, I was now graduating from college and I hadn't even taken an acting class yet, you know, so I was about to take my first acting class. I was very excited. He goes, go down the hallway to my girlfriend, Davy, and she just left. He said, what are you going to do to support yourself? And I said, I bartend. You know, I bartended my way through college, paid for all of it myself. And he said, go down the hallway and see my friend, Davy in Littlefield, who you probably remember. She was a manager for years. And he said, she just left Click Modeling, and she's like my liaison to the modeling industry. I think maybe you should talk to her about possibly modeling. I'm like, you think? I go down there. She sends me to this woman that she worked at Click with that left because she started a new agency. The agency was like literally 3 months old. It was called Men Model Management. She was running it out of her apartment on 12th and Broadway.
Right.
I go to her office. She looks at me, and one of the guys sitting on the couch in her living room, she's like, Bruce would love him. Bruce is going to love him. And I'm like, who's Bruce? And they go, Bruce Weber. And I'm like, oh, cool. And they're like, do you know who that is? And I said, no. And they're like, oh my God, Bruce is so good to love. He didn't even know who Bruce is. And I'm like, who is he? Yeah. You gotta remember, this is 1985.
Right.
I said, I don't know. I'm not going to pretend like I know. I don't know who Bruce Weber is. He goes, he's a very important photographer. I said, I know, you know, Richard Avedon. I've heard of him. Like, I'm trying to like impress them like I do.
Right.
She picks up the phone. She goes, Bruce, I got this kid here. You're in the studio now. Can I send him over now? She sends me over. I say to her, my brother gave me 2 subway tokens to come here and to come back to his apartment. I don't have any money. She turns to the guy in her office. She gives me like 20. I said, and I'm hungry. I said, I got to get some lunch. And she gave me like 10 bucks. She goes, go get a sandwich. And here's a subway token home. Give me 10 or 20 bucks. And she goes, somehow I think this is going to be a good investment. I go to see Bruce. He's like, so your name is Billy? You're a political science major? And you want to be an actor? Stop doing that. I'm like, what am I doing? And you know what I was doing?
What?
I'm not lying. I got so self-conscious, I started to freaking Zoolander on him. And I did this. I was like, I started sucking my face in a little bit to make it look more like, svelte.
Yes.
He was like, no, stop doing that. I go, what am I doing? He goes, you know, that thing you're doing with your face. And I was like, oh my God, he could tell that I was doing it. I go back to my brother's apartment. The phone rings. My brother's like, hello. Billy? Yeah, he's right here. Nadia? Yeah, sure. He gets a phone call. Somebody named Nadia? He hands me the phone. She's laughing her ass off of the phone, howling, laughing. He goes, did I tell you, Calvin? Did I tell you Bruce was going to love you? Congratulations, you just booked Calvin Klein. And I literally went from Michael Bloom to Davy Littlefield to Nadia to Bruce back to my brother's apartment in 4 hours. And I booked the Calvin Klein jeans campaign. I wasn't even out of college yet.
Wow.
I shot to California. I'm now in this restaurant in Paris telling Calvin this. I said, I shot it. I said, I shot it for 10 days in Zuma and Malibu. And I got paid more money in those 3 days with all of the usage, you know, cards, bus shelters, magazines, domestic, international, billboards. I made more money in that shoot than my father made in 3 years.
Wow.
In 10 days, I'm right out of the gate, and I make more money than my father does in 3 years. I cash the check. I pay the commissions to my agent. I go right to the bank, and I wipe out my college student loans. I'm out of college 6 months, and I don't owe anybody a penny.
Wow.
I go to Calvin. I go, Calvin, you changed my freaking life. You changed
Wow.
my life. I said, that gig that Bruce hired me for you, that jeans campaign, I made more money than my dad did in 3 years, and I paid off my college loan. And he was like, I never heard that story. Yeah, it's great, right?
That is a great story, Billy.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, but you modeled after that. You still did some more modeling, right?
Yeah, but it was all, I didn't move to New York to become a model. I moved to New York to take my first acting class. And
I see, yes.
And I went to see Michael Bloom, and I said, my brother Alex said, I'm going to set you up with Michael. He would be a great advisor right. for you. It would be great advice. And he didn't say, I'm going to sign you or anything. He's like, I don't know anything about you, except for you're Alex's brother, and I love your brother, you know? And I'm doing this for your brother as a favor. And
Wow.
Yeah, and I took my first couple of acting classes, but it was nice because when you're bartending, you know, in the New York clubs, you're working till when you're cleaning up after everybody leaves, you work until 6 a.m, right?
Right.
And when you're modeling, you could do one gig out in the Hamptons and you could put away enough money to pay the bills for
right.
months. I mean, that money I made on the Calvin Klein thing is the biggest money you get is the big advertising campaigns.
Wow.
And after I paid the commission, paid the taxes, paid my college loans off, I still had like 40 grand in cash left. Wow. So that was enough money to support me living. I had a 700 square foot apartment where I lived with my best friend, Chris Bevilacqua, and my brother, Stephen. There was three of us living in a 700 square foot one bedroom for 8 years. So I was keeping my costs down.
See what I mean? Paying dues, brother. When was your first big break, Bill? You would say in acting.
I would say that my first big break was probably, the first big break that had, quite a few big breaks, man. But the first one that I felt the most was when Mike Figgis put me in Internal Affairs.
Yeah. You know what? I love that movie. I think that was a great movie. Yeah. Did that get the credit it deserves, that movie, Bill?
It certainly did. I'll tell you right now, you were there. At that time, John Travolta and Richard Gere were ice cold. John Travolta was doing like Look Who's Talking. And Richard Gere, I don't know what he was doing. And all of a sudden, he does Internal Affairs. And it's the notices on Internal Affairs, the critical notices for the film and for Richard Gere. He's back. He's dark. He's better than ever. He does not get Pretty Woman without the notices on Internal Affairs.
Wow.
I don't think I'm offended. If you ever watch that, I don't think you'd be offended by me saying that. He got Julia Roberts. Ironically, Julia Roberts has cast approval, right? This is after she did Steel Magnolias. She's already becoming a big star, Academy Award nominee. And she has cast approval, and Gary Marshall loved the idea. And that had, after Pretty Woman, that guy went on to make the next 20 movies.
Yes.
His minimal payday was $10 million.
Yeah, I thought he was great. I thought you were great in Internal Affairs. I love the movie. I thought Andy Garcia was great in it.
Yeah, and Laurie Metcalf.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God.
He had a great cast, Michael Beach. And the same thing happened with Travolta with Pulp Fiction, right? I mean, that catapulted him back to major super A-list, name above the title superstardom. After Pulp Fiction, it sort of resuscitated. It would give him the paddles. It brought him back.
You know what's amazing? Because I heard he offered it to somebody else instead of Travolta. And then when that person turned it down, who knows if that's true, then Travolta got it. I mean, do you ever, and you don't have to answer this, is there any movies that you ever turned down that you regret?
Yeah. Yeah, I was offered Speed 4 times.
Speed?
Yeah.
Keanu Reeves, Speed?
Yeah, and the chairman of the studio took me into his office one-on-one. I can't remember the gentleman's name, who was the head of Fox at the time. But when I took that meeting with him one-on-one, and I said no after I left that meeting, I never worked for Fox again,
Isn't that amazing?
But you know what? I had done Flatliners. Here was my logic. I had done Flatliners. You could totally appreciate this. I had done Flatliners with Jan DuPont. He had never directed before. He was a technical guy. He was a shooter. English was not his first language. This was his directing debut. And I didn't really think he was an actor's director. And I also was like looking for the first movie I did after Backdraft. I didn't work for 2 years. And the first movie I did was Turning Down Everything. And the first movie I did was Three of Hearts. And I wanted to do something that was about the acting. And to be in this action movie, and I look back and I regret it. And when they did that later one on the boat with Jason Patrick.
Yes.
I came back crawling into Jan DuPont's office on my hands, begging forgiveness because he wanted me to do it. They wanted me to do it. I turned it down. I was also offered River Runs Through It. But I wasn't available. I couldn't make that work. I was also cast and about to start rehearsal in Thelma Louise, and they flopped this Gina Davis's availability switch, and it conflicted with shooting Backdraft. So I had to choose between the two, and of course it was the Brad Pitt part, and I had to choose between Thelma Louise and Backdraft, which is, I made the obvious choice, the right choice of playing the lead in a film with Bob and Kurt and Ron. But I really, really do regret not doing that. And also one time I was offered the Doc Holliday role in Tombstone.
Oh, Tombstone,
Val Kilmer. And I literally got off the plane from Backdraft, went into the meeting with Kevin Jarre. He said, I want you to play Doc Holliday. I said, it's great. That's great. I said, who's playing Wyatt Earp? He said, Kurt Russell. He just left 10 minutes ago. And I had just left Kurt 3 days ago in Chicago. And I'm thinking this big testosterone Western where Kurt's playing number one and I'm playing number two. I just did that for 7 months. I just did that in the fire department with him. And I'm like, I don't think I want to do that. And I screwed up. Now, having said that, what Val Kilmer did with Doc Holliday was really, really special and yes. really breathtaking. And he brings, they talk about a guy that brings his pain and his suffering
yes.
to his work. I really, it's a manifestation of all of the little, you know,
yes.
by a thousand cuts. This guy's experienced, I think probably a lot of it's self-inflicted, but
yes.
he's just a super, he's a talented guy. I've never had the pleasure of spending a lot of time with him. But I've met him a couple times.
He seems like a really nice guy.
He's like a tortured, tormented artist, you know?
Right.
Like Bill Hurt, you know, like real deep, you know, but a complicated guy. You know?
Yeah. I mean, anyway, the only role I ever turned down I was supposed to direct a movie that I wrote, and they said, You got to commit to the movie, and I committed to the movie, and I turned down.
All right, can I answer this?
Go ahead.
Is it the initials TS?
What is it?
Are the initials of the character TS?
TS?
No?
No.
Okay.
No. That was one, but yeah, I forgot about it.
Can we talk about that? Were you, what do you mean, the only one?
Yes, I was offered Tony Soprano.
Yes. And, I didn't want to bring it up if you didn't want me to bring it up.
No, but you know what? I couldn't really do it at the time. There was no way I could have done it. And that's because that's 27 years ago. That's when I got out of the hospital. I had throat cancer, and I was just not able to. There was just no way I could have done it. I needed 6 months of recovery to really get my strength back. And that's why I turned it down. But you know what? I was never on that show. I don't know what it is. You turn down something, they never put you on the show again. Yeah. But I felt bad because it wasn't because of the material. I remember reading the pilot, loving it. Yeah. But I said, my wife looked at me and said, you're not ready to go back to work yet. And so I don't make, and you know what? And God rest his soul. James Gandolfini was so brilliant in it. That,
yeah. Hey. Yeah.
No, but the movie I was talking about was Donnie Brasco, which I love the movie, and was the Sonny Black role, and Michael Madsen was terrific in it, but I was offered it, and God, and I love that movie so much. That's why I'm so upset. Every time I see that movie, I go, it's just such a good movie, and everybody's so good in it, and I thought that was Pacino's, one of his top performances ever. Yeah. So, but anyway, hey, you know, that's
Michael,
why.
Michael Madsen's another guy, man, where his work and his soul come through
He's great. Michael Madsen's great.
He's one of my dear friends. I've done 5 or 6 movies with him.
Yes, I love Michael. He was great in it. And you know, but being an actor, I'm a little jealous that I could have been in it. But hey, you know, that's the way it goes. Bill, you know, a lot of people don't know that you really were a college wrestler, right?
Yeah, I wrestled from 4th grade through college. It's a great passion of mine. I wrestled for Binghamton University when it was a Division III program. It's now Division I. They got some real, real badasses on that team right now. We got one kid that's ranked 4th in the country. We've got like 5 kids on the team that are undefeated right now. We've got 3 or 4 kids that are nationally ranked. One's as high as number 4 in the country. And we compete in the EIWA, which is one of the oldest most treasured athletic conference is called the Eastern Intercollegiate Wrestling Association. I don't know, it's 150 years old. And it's us and Lehigh and Hofstra and Bucknell and Rider and then all the Ivy Leagues, Harvard. The really good Ivy Leagues are, the best is Cornell, second best is Princeton, and then Penn is a little bit distant after those two.
But isn't Ohio State
the same conference? If you're wrestling in the same conference as Cornell, Princeton, Lehigh, Bucknell, those are some very, very good wrestling schools. Very good.
Wow. I know. I remember you always told me, Chaz, if you ever get into a fight and you see the guy's got cauliflower ears, walk away. Yeah. You told me that. I never forgot that.
Yeah. And you told me the story about the only time you ever got, when you were at the door at the limelight.
When I was bouncing, yes.
You were a beetle.
I was a beetle.
Yes. Beetle on his back. This guy had you on your back in 2 seconds.
He had me on my back. I'll never forget it. He double leg locked me, put me on my back, And I told you the story. I never forgot it because I tried to put my hands and roll them, and it was like I had a mountain. It was like I had a mountain on top of me because, you know, you told me why, because they know how to bridge their arms and legs.
Well, no, I mean, you do that. You know, the whole thing about doing something 10,000 times, when you're in a wrestling room 3 hours a day, 6 days a week for 15 years, and then all of a sudden you don't wrestle anymore, and you're like walking the streets and you're going into the limelight. Now you're 26, 20. You haven't wrestled in 3 or 4 years. You don't forget that stuff. Wow. So all of a sudden the bouncer comes up to you and says, "I don't think so, pal. Let's go. You're out." And then, you know, the shit hits the fan and you wind up on your back. Every wrestler can wipe out a boxer, and every jiu-jitsu guy can wipe out a wrestler. Because of the holds, you know, a wrestler can take you to the ground. A lot of those jiu-jitsu guys pull you down on top of them. They want to be on bottom, and then they get a hold of your wrist, your thumb, your elbow, your ankle, and they shatter it.
Right. So well, actually, Joe Rogan, if I'm not mistaken, I could be wrong, but I thought he said in a street fight, the one that's the toughest in a regular street fight is the wrestler. I thought he said that.
My offense takes away everybody else's offense. My offense. You know, every fight I ever had in my life, I always took one in the side of the head because I went in with my head down.
Right.
I went in with my head down. I take one on the side of the head. But once you were close enough to hit me, I was close enough to get a hold of you. Once I got a hold of you, you better get two or three more good shots as you're going down on your back because it's over.
Once those wrestlers get a hold of you, that's it. Billy,
I do the color commentary for ESPN. I've covered the Olympic trials. The world championships, and of course to cover NCAA collegiate wrestling. I've done that for years now. That's a fun gig that I have. That I do as a favorite, not really to ESPN. I do it as I'm like an ambassador for the sport. I do it as a favor to help promote wrestling.
Right, right. Wow, and I know you still do a lot for the school of Binghamton when you can. That I know.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's great. What do you have? I mean, is there anything you want to talk? You would like to talk about what's going on right now with you?
I'm developing a new concept for a series. It's based on a lot of the stuff we've always talked about over the years, and I think you would really appreciate it. You know, I might actually run it up the flagpole with you when the time comes, because I think there's something fascinating to be examined. The difference, something we already touched upon, the difference between our generation, the way our parents raised us, and how differently the children of one generation later are being raised. I mean, the way my father used to do stuff with us, my father was a Brooklyn street kid. He was in the Marine Corps. Then he went to Syracuse and played football. He got multiple degrees there. So he was kind of a nice combination of like a street tough kid who was also, I wouldn't say he was an intellectual, but my father was very bright.
Right.
And very, very kind man. And it's sort of like the Wonder Years if Marty directed it. It's like that Fred Savage show, The Wonder Years. It's like examining our lives, my childhood in the 70s, and the shit we did and the shit we got away with and the way the cops handled it and the way our parents handled it and the way our teachers handled it, as opposed to today. You're thrown out of the school. There's a lawsuit. I had a kid on a wrestling team who was having a problem, and he was causing problems, and they had to throw him off the team. And then the parents called the athletic director, and they said, "Our son has emotional problems, and if he does anything to hurt himself, we're going to hold you personally liable." So the athletic director called the coach and told them to reinstate the kid. Now, you imagine in our generation, like your mother calling up the coach and saying, "You know, I'm going to sue you. If you threw my kid off the team, I'm going to sue you unless you put him back on the team." And they do it.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. And all the political correctness. Like, my dad was not – he was a very funny guy, but he did this really funny thing one time where he would – my mother would make chicken. And his football team would get on the bus with their shoulder pads on, everything, on their way to, like, a scrimmage to go to Farmingdale to go scrimmage a rival team. My father would have this big box from, like, the supermarket, and it was filled with brown sacks with chicken wrapped in it in a napkin. And my mother would make chicken for the whole team. This is 1971, 1967, 71, 73. And my father would walk down the aisle of the bus, and he would say, "Hey, Chaz, you a breast man or a leg man?" And you would answer, "Oh, coach, oh, man, you know me, coach, I'm a breast man." All right, he'd throw him a chicken breast. go to the next guy. You're a breastfeeder. Oh, you know me, I'm a leg man. You give him a piece of dart, you give him a drumstick.
You couldn't do that.
Do that today?
You can't do that today.
You can't do that today. That was the kind of stuff that not only the kids thought was funny, but the parents thought it was funny, and the mothers thought it was funny. You know,
well, you know what, Bill? My show, we never talk politics, but but how do you feel about that? You think that's hurt us, or is it better to go back to that way, or are we too sensitive now, or too politically correct?
No, it's too sensitive. It's a shame. It's a shame.
I don't know. I just think that we got to do more for our kids in school, young kids, and I think when you get the kids young, you know, I've been to a lot of schools in the Bronx, and I talk to the young kids there, and I try to, like, you know, instill in them about the saddest thing in life is wasted talent, and I could see that they're so hungry for that, caring for information. You know, I just think that we got to get the kids sooner, before they hit the street, because once they hit the street, when they become 11, 12, 13, it's too late then. You know, it's just too late. The street becomes their father. The street becomes their parents. Mm-hmm. And I just think that, you know, look, you got great kids. God bless. I have great kids. But that's because we took care of them. We were on them. Hey, yeah. This is wrong. You can't do that. I'm mm-hmm. sorry you can't do that. Okay, this is okay. You have to work for this. You just can't get it for nothing. And we both did that. And your wife, for those people who don't know you, your wife is the great Chyna Phillips, you know, and the great singer from Wilson Phillips. And, you know, she's...
30 years, Chaz. We're right behind you. What year did you get married?
What's that?
What year did
you get married? We got married in 93.
95 for us. I met her in 91, married her in 95. But you guys, when did you meet Chyna?
90.
Yeah, so we're like nipping at your heels. Yeah, we're like a year behind.
I mean, we've been together. We've been with our wives a long time, and you know, in this business, that's a rarity. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, 30 years, and Chaz and Gianna are the godparents of my third born child. Godparents of my child. And one little secret that your fans don't know is that your wife set me up on my first date with who? You don't remember?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I could say that?
Yeah.
With Julia Roberts.
With Julia.
That's right. With Julia.
A blind date with Julia Roberts when Julia was 19.
When Julia was 19.
She had been in New York. It was the weirdest thing. I go to Gianna's apartment. She's cooking dinner. She says, I have this girl I want to set you up with. I get there. She's got no shoes and socks on. She's got no jeans on. I'm like, what's your name? Julia. Where are you from? I'm from Georgia. Where? Smyrna. How long have you been in New York? I just got here a couple of weeks ago. I'm like, great, I'm really connecting with her. She says, we're playing Jewish geography, where are you from? I said, I'm from Massapequa. She goes, oh, I got a couple friends from Massapequa. I go, really, who? She goes, Eggie and VP, Timmy Van Patten. And I'm like, you just said, how do you know them? She goes, I've been hanging out with them at Tobey Beach. I said, you said you just got here 3 weeks ago. She goes, I did. I said, you got here 3 weeks ago, you go to the beach that I'm a lifeguard at, and you know two of my best friends. I mean, VP wasn't one of my best friends, but I'd known him since Timmy Van Patten, you know, the great Timmy Van Patten. We went to high school together, and he wrestled for the Riley. He wrestled for Chris Bevilacqua's father at Massapequa High School. It was really cool. The Bevilacquas and the Baldwin kids all went to the Crosstown Rival, and we all played football against my dad, and we all wrestled against Chris's dad. We went to war against our fathers. But yeah, Gianna set me up on a blind date with Julia. She was 19 years old. She'd been in New York. She blew my mind because she was like Massapequa, Tobey, Eggie, which is a guy named Richie Eggstein, and Timmy Van Patten. And we totally hit it off. And we were super tight. That was 86, 87-ish. And we
You were tight for a while.
We were tight for a couple of years. Yeah, we were tight. And then, you know, we used to go see Kevin Uvain and Risa Shapiro. And they were like, look, we really want to try and, like, we want to try and represent you guys, but, like, you don't even have a credit yet. You don't even, because I didn't have an agent. I was taking acting classes. And they were at William Morris. It was before Kevin Uvain went to CAA.
That's right. Yes.
87, you know? And, but I remember those first acting classes, Chaz. It was a real affirmation. Because, you know, some of the best ones I've been told have never even taken an acting class. I've been told Susan Sarandon and some of the great actors on screen.
Well, they were able to learn while they worked. You know, they were, I think you, the lessons they learned, I mean, some people are naturally gifted and they learn as they go on, you know?
I felt like I was in over my head. I was learning as I was going along, because the second audition that I had was for Born on the 4th of July. I auditioned for Braman and Hopkins, and it was a Catherine Bigelow film, Blue Steel, that Oliver was producing.
Right.
And I did a really great job. It was a part that Tom Sizemore got. They said, listen, we're casting another thing for Oliver next week, Born on the 4th of July, and we'd like you to come in for it. They told Oliver, this is kid's Billy Baldwin. You know his brother Alec, because he was in talk radio, the thing with Eric.
Right.
So Oliver said, yeah, bring him in. So I walk in there. Nobody's in the room. It's just me and Oliver. And my brother warned me. He's like, this dude, can we use any language we want on this show?
Absolutely.
He said, he's going to fuck with you, man. Trust me, he's going to fuck with you. And if you don't go toe-to-toe and blow-for-blow with him, you're done. So whatever, trust me, something's going to go down in this audition where he's going to mess with your head. And I walk in, it's just me and Oliver. He looked like he was high as a kite. He looked like he had smoked a big fat one before I got in there. And he said, are you familiar with the material? And I said, not only am I familiar with the material, I know Ron Kovic. And he's like, well, how do you know Ron Kovic? And I said, I'm from Massapequa. My father was his high school teacher. And when I was 5 years old, my father used to take me to the Bronx VA, and he would sit in his room and he would read the Sunday New York Times and read Life magazine and Time magazine and Newsweek magazine, because he was a full quadriplegic and all they had was the television in his room that had the three channels. He had WPIX and ABC, NBC, CBS. And my father would go in there and read literature. He would read like Hemingway to him. He would do it like once, you know, he'd do it like once, one Sunday a month. He'd drive in from Massapequa to take some pressure off my mother. He'd grab me and one of my brothers. I'd sit on the floor and play with my toys. I was 5, 6 years old. And when I told Oliver Stone that, he's like, you're kidding me. I said, yeah, I know Ron. I mean, I used to go visit him in the hospital. I don't recall conversations with him. I was a kid. I was 6 years old. So, and he said, if you can walk and chew gum, like, you're going to be in this movie. I said, look, I'd love to be in your movie. Even if I'm not, I'd love to take you and Tom Cruise out to Massapequa. You'll meet everybody. You'll meet his coaches. You'll meet his teachers. I'll bring you to his childhood home. I'll introduce you to all the neighbors in the neighborhood. I'll take you to the famous burger joint out there, All American, where Ron used to go every Friday night. It still exists in pristine condition, the way it looked in the 1950s. So he's like, no, you're going to the Philippines with us. I'll see you in the Philippines. And I said, my brother warned me about you. I said, you better not be kidding. If you're messing with my head, if I don't want it, he's like, get out of here. Tell you, because you're going to the Philippines. Get out of here.
Now, Bill, is it true that your other two brothers are in that film too?
Daniel and Steven are both in it in the Massapequa sequences that are shot in Dallas. I'm in the Vietnam sequences.
Right.
Where
wow.
I was featured with Cruz and Jason Gedrick most of the film.
I remember that. Kind of
hustling my way into a couple of lines. I mean, it was like a glorified extra. But, you know, they shot that in January, and back then for Academy consideration, they would release it in the Thanksgiving Academy season.
Wow.
Now they release Academy Award films in March, you know, but then they would release. And that was when they weren't cutting the film as they were shooting it. They would finish the film and then start cutting it. So I shot the film in January, and they didn't release it until December. So every time I went to a meeting, the casting director say, what you're doing now? They're like, so what are you up to? I said, well, you know, I just got back from the Philippines. I was working on a movie. They're like, great. Which movie? I was like, yeah, I was working on this movie. I don't know if you heard of it. It's called Born, which I knew everybody did. I was like, it's called Born on the 4th of July. They're like, what? You're working with Tom Cruise and Oliver Stone. Like, yeah, you know, I was over in the PI. I was there for a couple of months. So when I said I was there for a couple of months, they didn't know. I had one line for every month. I had three lines.
Hey, man, you did it.
Yeah.
And Tom Cruise was great in that movie. I thought he was great in that movie.
You know, he's really, really, really good in, I mean, I haven't seen everything he's done, but I really liked him in so many of the things that he's done. I mean, you know, when you look at Rain Man and all those beautiful performances, the Color of Money and, you know, Top Gun. I mean, this is the most highly anticipated sequel in years and years and years. This sequel, if there was no COVID and that got a chance for a normal theatrical release, I think that would have been the highest grossing film for sure. I think in a month it would have made $3 billion. You know, it's a kind of movie.
Yeah.
Like you release that movie in India and Pakistan, it still translates. Even if people watching it don't totally follow it because it's just such incredible, the girls and the action and the jets and the motorcycles and everything. It's like,
I thought it was a great movie.
Yeah.
Bill, before we go, because we're coming to the end here, you got to tell the audience, because I remember the story she told me. I got to verify by you. Your wife, China, told me a story that a certain rock star saved her life when she was in the water. Is that true?
Yeah. She was, you got to remember, my wife, her parents were the founding members of the Mamas and Papas, John and Michelle Phillips. Her parents got divorced when she was two.
Right.
And she lived with Warren Beatty for 4 years, Jack Nicholson for 3 years. Her mother married Dennis Hopper. Her mother had on again, off again with Warren Beatty. With Mick Jagger. She went to the Ice Capades with Michael Jackson. She would have Orson Welles and Groucho Marx at her house all the time. Her mother had these legendary dinner parties that I would go to all the time. It would be like Jackie Collins and, Bob Shea and, Ed Begley Jr. and James Coburn and Bill Maher. And I was like, this is so cool. This is so old Hollywood. We're having a dinner party with all these cool people. But yeah, she got swept away. Her father was holding her little brother. Her little brother was a couple months old and she was just a few years old. She was 2 or 3 years old and a big wave came up and crashed on them in Malibu. And John fell and dropped Tamerlane and he got swept away. And John stood up in the water and looked at China and looked at Tamerlane, and Tamerlane was an infant. And he dove into the water and the next wave came up. And when the next wave came up, somebody dove off their balcony into the water to go after China. And it was Jimmy Page. It was Jimmy Page from Led Zeppelin. And I'm like, well, what happened after that? And she's like, he invited us up to the house and then he made some tea. And my father smoked a joint with him and then they started playing and then they started jamming and then they kind of wrote like half a song together. And I'm like, when I told her, she told me my mother lived with Warren and she lived with Jack and she married Dennis and she was, friends with Mick. And when I told her my father was a high school teacher and he coached the football team and he was my little league coach and he ran the Cub Scouts, she went into the kitchen and she tore off a piece of Reynolds wrap and she twisted it into an engagement ring and she came back into the room with like snot pouring out of her nose, bubbles of snot and choking on her tongue. And she fell to her knees and she put the aluminum foil ring on me and she proposed to me. And when I told her my dad was my Cub master, that was like, this is my key to stability. Like, this is the answer. I'm going to have the picket fence. I'm going to have the dog and I'm going to have I'll have two or three kids. I'll have the Dalmatian. I'll have the picket fence. I'll live in the suburbs. This is the guy that's going to bring it home, And she was so used to all this craziness with, living with Jack and all of this. Right. She always had incredibly wild Hollywood childhood,
Wow. Well, you make a great pair together. You've been married almost 30 years. Excuse me. I love your wife. Please tell her we said hi, John and I. And Bill, it's been great. You are just such a great interviewer. So funny, so bright. Really, thank you so much for being on my show. And I hope to have you again another time because you are a classic. And like Billy Baldwin says, he's the white sheep of the family. Which I love.
One time we should do... I want to tell your fans that I was in his house, in his kitchen, and in that room that he's in right now, in that man cave, 4 days a week for like 3 years. I lived in Bedford, in Bedford for 3 years. I was there like literally like 4 days a week. Sometimes I felt like I was overstaying my welcome,
No, and, never, Billy, never.
Yeah, never. Remember, just tell him the one-liner when you came to my house to eat that one time. Do you remember that story? What was it like?
I give you 7-course meals, and I come in here, and China gives me a slice of Swiss cheese. Cheese. Yes,
she
a cheese
like
slice.
You're like a slice of
Milky. Oh, God. Those are great.
I mean, your mother and your mother-in-law, may she rest in, God bless her.
Yes.
Just an amazing home that you ran. So many memories. And by the way, I don't have to come back on this one more time. I should come back on this 10 more times because all of the stories that I have told you and all of the stories you have told me.
Yes.
We didn't even crack the first 1%.
Well, you will be back, Billy. The fans would love to see you. And thank you so much for coming down, thank Bill. You. And you know what, Billy? You still got all that hair, damn it. You still look fantastic.
How much would you pay? How much you told me?
$500,000 right now.
$500,000.
I'd write the check right now to have all that hair. God bless you.
Because you're a smart man. If you had $500,000, you'd be making, you know, with this hair, you'd be making $20 million a picture. I'll give you some of my hair. You sprinkle some of your fairy dust talent on me. And
oh, come on, Billy. All right, Billy. God bless. Say hello to the family for me.